From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The Memphis soul label Stax Records is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Tribute concerts and a PBS documentary are part of the lineup. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with musicians who were a big part of the Stax sound. First, guitarist, songwriter, and producer Steve Cropper, best known for his playing with Booker T and the MGs. And Isaac Hayes tells us about writing the classic hit Soul Man for Stax. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Simpsons Movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Stax Records produced some of the most important Southern soul music of the 60s. Music by such performers as Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Booker T and the MGs, Isaac Hayes, and the Staple Singers. Here's some examples of the Stax sound. Stax Records was based in Memphis. It evolved out of the pop and country label Satellite, which was started in 1957 by Jim Stewart, who ran it with his sister, Estelle Axton. To mark that 50th anniversary, Concord Records, which acquired the Stax catalog, has been celebrating all year, with reissues and concerts. Next week, PBS will air a documentary called Respect Yourself, The Stax Records Story. We thought we'd join the celebration by bringing you two of the people who helped create the Stax sound. First, Steve Cropper. Cropper was the house guitarist at Stax Records. The house band recorded their own records under the name Booker T and the MGs. Cropper also worked as a songwriter and producer for Stax. He produced some of Otis Redding's hits.
I've been loving you become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you. I don't want to stop now. Oh. With you, my life has been so wonderful.
Steve Cropper spoke to Terry Gross in 1990. He told her he always thought of himself as a rhythm guitar player.
I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception in the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
You had your first hit with a band called The Marquise.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section. You became a producer. You became a songwriter with
Floor Sweeper.
Stax. Yeah,
right. Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with the Marquise?
He was the tenor player with the Marquise. He was on the record last night and everything. He came to me and he said, "I hear you guys got a pretty good band." He said, "You know, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band." And I said, "Well, I'm not really interested. Well, I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group." And I said, "How long have you been playing?" You know, and he said, "Oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months." And I'm going, "Oh yeah, great," you know. And somewhere in the conversation, he goes, "Oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio." And I said, "Can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday?" And that is a true story. Now I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around, and then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label, and we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And of course, Jim Stewart said that we never had a chance, we'd never make it, but I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something, and we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day, and until the time that we came up with last night. But what happened was, Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop, and I sold records. That's what I did, and I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in, and on Saturdays I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that, and that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, "Wait a minute." He said, "You know, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in the record shop and whatever." And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full-time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions, and I think this was it's a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquise, and we had this big hit record last night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I'd already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Robey, I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al TNT Braggs. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, and everybody just fell in love with him.
Let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T. and the MGs. Guitarist Steve Cropper is my guest. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock at the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. And that's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over, and I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really, he might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform. And that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that. And that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked, worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with, and I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like
same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
That's Otis Redding, who worked with guitarist, songwriter, and producer Steve Cropper, who spoke to Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1990 interview with guitarist Steve Cropper, who was also a songwriter and producer for the Stax Records label in the 1960s.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, you know, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour. And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there and presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple ideas. And what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel. And Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written and Don't Fight It. They said, we're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going. And they left, and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits. Very lucky me, huh?
Well, let's hear In the Midnight Hour. Wilson Pickett in the Midnight Hour, co-written by my guest Steve Cropper, who's featured on guitar. You also did a lot of work playing behind Sam and Dave, and Sam and Dave were the inspiration for the Aykroyd and Belushi group, the Blues Brothers, and you played with them as well. What did you think of the Blues Brothers when they got started, or when you got started, or whatever? What did you think of? Did you think that it was a parody that was in bad taste at all? You know, like two white guys doing their parody of black singers, two white guys who probably fantasize about themselves sometimes of being being black singers. But what was your take on it?
Well, you know, they got a lot of bad rap on that, I think, initially. And a lot of people, for some reason, thought that John and Danny were kind of scoffing black musicians for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case at all. And what I found out was really the contrary to all of that. They had such a love for that kind of music, for rhythm and blues and so forth. And I couldn't believe, I went to John's house one day, and he showed me a collection of blues stuff that I just blew me away. I'd never seen that big of a collection of blues music. Of course, being in Chicago, he had a lot of access to a lot of stuff that, of course, we never heard in Memphis and so forth. It never really, most of it didn't reach the record shop that I worked in. But you mentioned about Sam and Dave being their influence. That is something that really came about whenever they decided to put a band together and got Duck Dunn and myself involved in the group. Because they were from the show, you know, from the routine they did on the show, their concept of an album at that point was strictly doing nothing but blues kind of songs. And, you know, things by the Down Child Blues Band and you know, Delbert McClinton stuff and all those kind of things. And I felt, you know, I'd been in the business a long time, and I felt if they wanted me to contribute anything to this, I thought they should go a little bit more commercial. And so it was my suggestion, along with Duck Dunn and all, that we do something like Soul Man. And we later did Who's Making Love as well. But we talked them into doing that, and then they started asking about, well, how did Sam and Dave do, you know? And so we kind of started showing them some of the routines, like some of the dance things that Sam and Dave would do on stage. And they go, yeah, man, this can be fun. So that's something that was sort of a new ingredient put in the Blues Brothers act as we started making preparation to do a show.
Guitarist, songwriter, and producer Steve Cropper speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Cropper was at Stax Records, whose 50th anniversary is being celebrated with concerts, reissues, and a PBS documentary, which airs next week. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our look at Stax Records with Isaac Hayes, and film critic David Edelstein reviews The Simpsons Movie. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're celebrating the work of artists from the legendary label Stax Records, which was based in Memphis and produced some of the most important soul music of the 60s. Stax's 50th anniversary is being commemorated with concerts and reissues by Concord Records, which acquired the Stax catalog, and by a documentary which airs next week on PBS called Respect Yourself, The Stax Records Story. Isaac Hayes recorded several hit records for Stax, including Hot Buttered Soul, Black Moses, and Shaft, and he was also an important behind-the-scenes figure, working as a producer, songwriter, and arranger. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. Hayes was also well known for his role as chef in South Park before he left the show last year. And despite a stroke in January, he's still performing, touring in the U.S. and Europe this summer. Terry spoke with Hayes in 1994 about his work at Stax Records. She asked him what he remembered about writing Sam and Dave's hit, Soul Man.
I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity. And they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences because, you know, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that, but realized that it, in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore it crossed the board, and then the groove and all everything else that went with it just made it, you know, very, very commercial.
So did you arrange this too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And are you featured instrumentally?
I wasn't featured. I just played piano on it. Well, you know, I did some little hot licks in there and stuff like that. So
okay. Well, let's hear Soul Man, co-written by my guest, Isaac Hayes. Guest is Isaac Hayes. You developed a style of singing in which you did long raps that kind of gave a backstory to the song, and the rap would lead you into the song. And the songs are often, you know, like pop tunes other people had written, like By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd kind of make up the whole story leading up to it. How did you start doing that, combining these raps with pop tunes?
Remember the famous quote in Cool Hand Luke? What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
Well, I did that. The rap came out of the necessity to communicate. And the way it happened was, there's a local club in Memphis, predominantly black, that was called a Tiki Club. And, you know, we'd hang out there. The barcades were playing there sometimes. So we'd hang out there and sit in, you know how musicians do. And this one day I heard this song by Glenn Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I said, wow, oh, that song is great. I mean, this man must really have loved this woman. And so I ran down the studio later on that day and said, man, y'all hear this song, Phoenix? Man, it's great. Everybody, yeah, you know, no enthusiasm. I'm saying, these guys don't feel what I feel. Are they getting it? So the Barcades were scheduled to play the Tiki Club a couple of days later, and I said, hey, man, I'm coming down and sit in with you guys. Learn By the Time I Get to Phoenix. They said, okay. I told him the key in E flat. And so I went down, and the club was packed. Go up on stage. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, y'all know him, blah, 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 Isaac Hayes. And there's all kind of conversations going, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, oh, man, how am I going to get these people's attention? So I said, hey, man, the first chord in the song, y'all hang up on it. It's a B flat 11. Just hang up on the chord. Just keep cycling it. And I started talking. And I just started telling this story. How it was a scenario, how about what could have happened to cause this man to leave, you know. And I started talking, and the conversations, halfway through the rap, that conversation started to subside. And when I reached the first line in the song, when I said, by the time I get to Phoenix, everybody went, wow. And, you know, when I finished the song, it wasn't a dry in the house.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of your recording of By the Time I Get to Phoenix. This is Isaac Hayes.
But one day, old boy got sick, and he had to come home. I don't have to tell you what he found. Oh, it hurt him so bad. He said, baby, mama, why? That's all he could say. But she said, oh, gone, fool, you doing it. But the man wasn't doing it, but that's the only excuse she could give him. He said, mama, I can't take it. I got to leave you. I'm going to leave you. Well, she tried to straighten up. She said she was going to straighten up. She got a little job to help him out with the bills, too. But that was just a sham. Because he found it again and again. And seven times he left this woman. And seven times he came back. And he had taken all that he could stand. And the eighth time that this went down, he said, mama, I got to go. He said, I'm leaving my heart right here. By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Isaac Hayes, do you feel a kind of special affinity with rap music now? Do you see do you feel a connection between what you were doing and what's being done now?
Well, some people try to equate it. In the sense that it's rap. Now, the only way I came close to this rap is the first verse in the song Shaft, and that is, who's a black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Well, that's rhythm. That's rapping in rhythm, and that's what this rap is today. I think that's the only similarity that I might have with the rap of today. Everything else, it differs.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Shaft, because that's the next stop on on this tour of your work. Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Melvin Van Peebles had put out a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. We had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So,
right.
So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music, and that's how that whole thing, that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you started using that wah-wah guitar funk style.
What happened was, I had been doing arranging all the time. I did a lot of arranging with the horns and stuff at Stax, and the first string arrangements I tried was a thing that Dave and I did on Sam and Dave. And that album was like a big flop. But we tried it anyway, but I had a taste for it. And once I tasted the strings, I couldn't let it go. Now, when sometimes in the studio you're working on various grooves and stuff and you can't find a name for it or you can't tag it with anything, you just, if it feels good, you say, okay, I'm going to file that. And you put it up. You put it back and you store it. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, now, what can I do? I thought about If you remember Otis Redding's Trial of Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal. You know, you got the na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. And he started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know, you know. And he did that, and it worked. I said, that's the kind of dramatic effect I want. Then I started putting the other things in, you know, the bass, the accents and all that stuff. But that's how that whole wah-wah thing came about.
Well, why don't I play some of your theme from Shaft, a classic. This is Isaac Hayes.
Isaac Hayes speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1994 interview with Isaac Hayes, who worked at the Stax record label in the 1960s.
Now, there's something I've been hoping to be able to play for you for a long time, and I'm just thrilled I have the opportunity to do it now. I want to play this record for you, and tell me, I figure you've probably heard it, and you could tell me what you think of it. So let's hear an excerpt, and then we'll talk about it.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. Black private eye, whose mastermind has got him what he wanted. Shaft. Shaft is the man.
Isaac Hayes, you recognize the recording?
Yeah.
Now, what did you think of Sammy Davis doing Shaft?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled, you know. I mean, you know, Sam and I were friends, and he wanted to do it, you know. And in fact, the night that we were in the studio doing that, it was the Golden Globe Awards. And I had no idea I would win, so Lou Gossett received the award in my stead. And I was in the studio with Sammy. Oh, wow.
It just seemed, you know, it's just really funny it's so out of character for him. I mean, he was going through this real kind of groovy period, I guess.
Yeah. You know Sammy, you know, he was into what was happening now, which is good. You know, he rolled with the trends.
And then years later came I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, Damon Ivory, Keenan Ivory Wayans, loving satire of all the blaxploitation films, which which of course you co-starred in. It's a wonderful film. You must have really enjoyed that.
Oh, man, we laughed throughout that film. I mean, we blew so many takes because it was hard to keep a straight face, you know?
Now, you know, at the time that Shaft and Superfly were really popular, I mean, everybody now, all the black filmmakers now, just credit those films with paving the way to all the new work that's happening now. But at the time, the NAACP was appalled at the black action films. And I wonder what your reaction was then to their reaction.
Well, you know, I had mixed emotions about that. That position was that, you know, it was painting a bad image, you know, for the kids and so forth, and there were no alternatives. Had there been some alternatives at that time, then I don't think the NAACP would have come down so hard. But what happened was, when they did that, it was like it turned off the tap. It totally dried up for us because Hollywood said, whoops, hands off. And they dropped everything, and our whole little thing just died. I think, you know, in hindsight, had there been a little more patience at the time, maybe it could have taken off in some other directions, because that was in, it was in its embryonic stage at that time, you know, the black cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And anything in its infancy, you're going to get some, you're going to get a lot of crap. You're going to get some inferior things and all of that, and the quality and so forth, and even questionable subject matters. But as the as that particular genre grows, then, you know, you start getting better films and so forth. And I think it, they might have made the move a little bit too soon, because when we were doing these things, we weren't taking ourselves seriously, not as the characters. We were just glad to get the work, glad to get the experience, glad that our people could see us on screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and
and as leading men.
Yeah, you know, and not with a broom and a mop and bowing and say, yes, sir, boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's why it took off and it was so widely received. And I think had it had a little time to go, a little longer, you know, you split off in some other areas, and Hollywood would have recognized that there is more that could sell than, you know, the pimps and the hookers and, you know, the private eyes and so forth.
I want to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about how you developed your image. When did you start shaving your head?
I started shaving my head not long after I got out of high school.
It wasn't fashionable then.
No, it wasn't.
To my knowledge. What inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, during those times as musicians, it was a fad. We had a relaxer in our hair. Called it a do, a conk process. And during that time, mine was cut very low and just slicked down on my head like all the way around like a coconut, you know. And it was hip. It was a style. But in the summertime, it was hard to keep up. And you sweat and it come undone and you had to sleep with a stocking cap on, all that kind of stuff. I said, I'm sick of fooling with this stuff. I'm going to cut it off. So I went to the barbershop around the corner from Stacks. I said, Mr. King, cut it all off. What? Cut it all off. I'm going to grow a new crop. And when he cut it off, you know, I went outside, you know, and I said, wow, it's a breeze out here. It feels great. I can feel the wind on my head. Hey, I think I'll keep it like this. I already had the beard. And people would look at me and say, oh, wow, oh, look at this guy, man. He's got baldy in the beard. But I didn't care because it was different. I like being different. You know, I like swimming upstream. And a funny thing, one time, Booker T, by some error, had somebody book two dates on the same day for Booker T and MGs. And one date was in, I think Booker had to go to Oklahoma somewhere. And I went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with Al, Duck, and Steve. And David Porter was a vocalist. And I was to pretend to be Booker T. And I'm at the organ. We kicked off the tune, kicked off Green Onions, you know, and grooving. Somebody said, hey, man, ain't no Booker T. He ain't got no hair. And, I mean, they were ready to riot. I jumped up from the organ and got out there with David, started dancing and singing and doing everything, trying to appease the people, you know. But finally, they said, well, okay, what the hell, we'll accept him.
Are you still doing it?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing about it is, it's ageless. So when I go naturally, no one will know.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure.
Isaac Hayes speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. He's among the artists who worked for Stax Records in the 60s. Stax's 50th anniversary is being celebrated with concerts and reissues and the documentary Respect Yourself, the Stax Record Story, which airs next week on PBS. Coming up, David Edelstein on The Simpsons Movie. This is Fresh Air. Years after The Simpsons made its debut as a weekly half-hour sitcom, there's finally a feature-length movie. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The Simpsons Movie is longer, more plot-driven, and has more showy animation than an average episode, but it rarely captures the show's magic, the lunatic free associations, the madcap highs. Like the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, it loses something when it's padded and ironed out to conform to a standard Hollywood story template. I'm frankly more of a South Park than a Simpsons guy, and yet the scatological savagery of South Park would hardly have been possible without The Simpsons. The show was a freak TV milestone. It's airing the upshot almost two decades ago of the fledgling Fox Network's attempt to differentiate itself from the Big Three. Matt Groening, James L. Brooks, and a writing team that boasted a lot of Harvard Lampoon alumni not only changed the way we saw primetime cartoons, they changed our notion of TV sitcoms. It turns out you can cram a TV show with TV parodies end to end and still find time for a plot. You can even sass Fox and Republican talking points on Rupert Murdoch's dime. The Simpsons Movie is rooted in the environmental crisis, a fashionable subject now, but one this show has always been in front on. One of its earliest and most memorable images was of a three-eyed fish from a polluted lake served up to Homer Simpson's boss, that rapacious captain of industry, Mr. Burns, and there's a variation of the same gag here. But Burns isn't the movie's chief pollutant. It's Homer, who blithely dumps a silo of pig manure into an endangered lake, and whose selfishness has epic consequences. Somehow, Homer brings about the quarantining and imminent nuking of his hometown, Springfield. And when the truth comes out, the whole town converges on him and Marge and Bart and Lisa and baby Maggie.
Homer, you have to go out there, face that mob, and apologize for what you did.
I would. I'm afraid if I open the door, they'll take all of you.
No, we won't. We just want Homer.
Well, maybe not you, but they'll kill Grandpa.
I'm part of the mob.
When the family escapes from the mob and heads for Alaska, where Homer says, "You can't be too fat or too drunk," the tensions escalate. His son Bart has already disowned him, preferring the pious ministrations of their next-door neighbor, Flanders. Even Homer's loyal wife is on the verge of giving him up for his selfishness.
I can't believe you'd say something so selfish.
Marge, those people chased us with pitchforks and torches. Torches! At 4 in the afternoon!
It was 7 at night.
It was during Access Hollywood.
Which is on at 4 and 7.
Go!
It's too bad that unlike other cartoon protagonists, Homer has always bored me silly. The voracious Cartman on South Park is like a character out of a Voltaire play, outsized with sleazeball stature. Hank Hill of King of the Hill is a befuddled everyman who's somehow both smaller and larger than life. SpongeBob SquarePants is an eternal optimist whose obliviousness is transcendent. But Homer remains a boob, a thickie, a foil for the appalled Bart, the socially conscious Lisa, and the devoted but chiding Marge. The dumber Homer is, the more the series, and now the movie, comes down to gags and pop culture parodies, jabs at TV, suburban cluelessness, political chicanery, and the heartlessness of big business and show business. The gags in the movie, unfortunately, are hit and miss. I like the Tom Hanks cameo and some Roadrunner-esque slapstick, but the writers get surprisingly little mileage out of President Arnold Schwarzenegger and his EPA director, Bob Cargill, a blandly resourceful totalitarian lunatic, although the latter is voiced with just the right degree of smugness by someone whose credit reads A. Brooks and sounds like the dad in Finding Nemo. One joke, though, is so brilliant it made me gasp. When what looks like a huge saucer from space hovers over Springfield, the people in a church run screaming into the bar next door, while at practically the same instant, the people in the bar run screaming into the church. You could write a whole sociology dissertation on that five-second gag. That's The Simpsons at its most glorious, and here, alas, all too fleeting.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Saxophone already.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards, on the web at creditcards.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a four-day-long meth binge for research purposes. We'll talk with journalist Frank Owen about the history of methamphetamine and about his own experiences with the drug. His new book is called No Speed Limit. Join us for the next Fresh Air.